I would like to start by taking a few minutes to see if anyone has anything you want to come back to in terms of what we did last week, the key differentiations, and if there was any follow-up, any further explorations that anyone did on these topics that you would like to get discussion about.
There was something that in the last differentiation that you posted that spoke to me about emotional safety, safety versus safety dependent on others. That's something that I haven't really integrated very well. If you had anything that you could share about that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, I can say two things at least about safety. I have this habit that I'm trying to overcome of saying ahead of time how many things I have to say about something as if I really know what will transpire once I start speaking. The first thing that I want to say is that the whole construction of our experience around safety is so primal that it's very hard for us to make any distinctions between observation and interpretation around anything that relates to safety. We tend to think in terms of this is not a safe place or this group is not safe. You know what I'm talking about, these kinds of thoughts? Instead of taking ownership and saying I am not feeling safe. You see the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And when I say this room is not safe, I basically give away my whole power. I make it all dependent on other people being a certain way that they aren't, and therefore there's nothing I can do. If I think of it in terms of I'm not feeling safe, this is an inner experience of mine, then a whole world opens up to see what can I do to increase my own sense of safety. And it might be make certain requests of people. It's not like we are barred from trying to create external conditions that line up with our needs. It's where is the source of it. Let me know if that was sufficient for you to get started.
I think that's a good starting place. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thank you for bringing this up. Anyone else with regards to any of the key differentiations, either the ones that are on the CNBC site or additional ones that Inval and I added?
I'm looking at the saying, someone is criticizing and blaming me, and I'm supposed to tell them that I'm scared. They will just walk all over me. I'm guessing that, no, we're not necessarily going to be telling people that we are scared, but I'm wondering if you could fill in a little bit.
Yeah, so first of all, the key differentiation that most jumps to me when I see this question is the one about vulnerability versus weakness. This idea that somebody will walk all over me if I show my vulnerability is the one that is at the heart of the issue here for me.
Okay. I'm thinking of a specific circumstance where it was a clinical situation and a client who I found out later was in fact abusing his children and his wife was taking kind of a power role. Okay, I'm speaking totally jackal. But
yes,
the time,
even the idea that he was abusing his wife and children is an evaluative idea. It's not a description of anything.
Right, even though, like, later on we find out that he is beating his wife, right?
He's beating his wife as a description. He's abusing her is not. Is that distinction clear?
Yes, okay.
And it's not that I disagree with that characterization. It's that that characterization, just entering that frame of mind, will diminish my ability to connect both with her and with him. If I think he is abusing his wife, he becomes a thing that's harder to connect with. You see what I mean?
I do. And ironically, at the time that I described a feeling that I was having, I didn't suspect this of him. And so I was trying to connect with him by sharing a feeling that I was experiencing. And I just remember it really well as being one of those situations where you wish you hadn't done that particular thing. And later on, realizing, aha, this is just putting yourself into, and I'm realizing, yeah, a whole bunch of beliefs are coming up with this when it comes to the idea that if we show vulnerability to someone who is meeting its own needs for self-esteem in ways that are not helpful to women, that whole thing is very confusing to me.
Yes, I'm a little torn about getting deeply into it. It's a topic that is very rich and is tangential to my purpose within this class. The only thing I want to focus on is the words like suspect, someone who is meeting his needs for self-esteem in ways that are not helpful to women, even though I know that you're trying to be descriptive. Just about anything that you say is distancing you from him in the way that I hear it. It's like, I cannot imagine being him. And when you do that, you diminish your power with this person. That's the key thing that I want to drive home here. You don't want to show vulnerability because there's something, I'm exaggerating, something bad and wrong about him, and you shouldn't. In that way, you've already separated from him. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Especially when you said, I can't imagine being him. Well,
yeah.
Automatically, yeah, put him in a otherworldly, you know, as if he's an alien or something. Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm not connecting.
That is the NVC move. At its heart is a radical commitment to not make anyone be alien. Anyone. No one. This is kind of like going back to the assumptions and intentions. No one. And it's very exacting. Not at all that we like what they did. Not at all even that we're not going to try to stop them from doing it. I would stop him from doing it if I was around and had the courage to do it. It's on the emotional level, I do not want to distance myself from him. I want to really, really, really imagine the world from within his experience, to be able to grasp emotionally how a human being who is no different from me could do the things that he's doing. That's the key piece that I want you to work away with. Can we leave it there?
For sure. Thank you.
You are most welcome. I see no further questions about what we were doing before, so I am officially opening up the question of interdependence. This is such a huge topic that I imagine that all of you could see from just reading the materials that this could be a series in and of itself, and maybe one day I will do that. So what I want to do is to first do a little bit of a conceptual review, and I want to do it by way of take a moment to see if anyone has, having reviewed the materials that I sent you about interdependence, if anyone has any question about any of the conceptual pieces.
I do have a question about this. It suggests holding your strategies and beliefs lightly, and I can certainly see holding my strategies lightly, and I can even understand that I may be more likely to get what I want if I can do that, because it makes me more powerful and flexible. I'm questioning holding and asking you to elucidate on this during the class, not to entirely answer it right now. The idea of holding one's beliefs lightly. That seems quite challenging to me because there are some things I believe very strongly in. And many of us have things that we believe that we would even die for. So how do you move to holding beliefs lightly from that position and without giving up your own contribution to other people in the world? So that's my broad question.
Oh, I love that question. And so I want to say that it may be that it would be useful to separate out the strategies and beliefs and say something a little different about them. I'm appreciating this as a form of feedback. What I want to say about beliefs is that I want to hold my beliefs lightly enough that I could conceivably, in theory, hear something that will make me change my mind.
Thank you, Mickey. That really helps me on that one.
And I remember a time many, many, many years ago before the first NVC book came out, when Marshall was coming to town and we were struggling to get 30 people to come into the room, there was a workshop in which somebody brought up the question, because there had just been a really, really painful incident of where someone had his migrant workers locked up in a hut at night, and there was fire, and they couldn't escape, and they died. So somebody said, how do you even talk with a person like this? And I remember Marshall saying, and it was so shocking to me at the time, and I've kind of like cycled to thinking about it, and he said, I want to go into the conversation with him in such a way that, in theory, I am open to the possibility that at the end of it, I would go forward with him to do the things that he does, because I will have changed my mind. He says, that's extremely unlikely. I don't want to make it zero. Something like this. I'm not quoting him, but do you understand? It's otherwise I'm not genuinely in dialogue.
I do understand.
And making it not binary is key. And this point about the willingness to be changed is essential if we are ever going to have a culture of dialogue. As part of what especially activists go into conversations with people, expecting them to change their mind when the activists themselves have zero willingness to even consider changing. And I can tell you that on a number of occasions, in small ways, I've heard things from people who had entirely different belief systems that really opened my mind to seeing a new thing, and there was a slight shift and tweak. Not like I now think radically different things, but I learned to see things in a slightly different way that makes room for things to be different, to be more open, to be more understanding.
Yes.
Thank you.
Hi, Nikki. One that I'm really wanting to hear what you've got to say about is connecting with our own innocence. It's such an interesting bind for me. So I'm really intrigued about hearing what you've got to say about holding myself as innocent.
Okay. Yes. So yeah. This is coming in the context of, you live in Australia, so I don't know if this kind of stuff happens there where there are workshops on issues of diversity and race relations, and something that here is called unlearning racism, or different names for this kind of work. Is that something that exists in Australia?
Yeah, very much so. In different areas, yeah.
Yeah. In much of that work that I have encountered in the United States, there is a way in which the white people take on a kind of guilt. Do you know what I'm talking about? Is this?
Yep.
And it's that I'm speaking to. There's something amazing about really, really, really taking in that in every moment of your life, you have done the best that you know to do to meet your needs, with the best intentions to do just that, and that all your ancestors who have done whatever they have done, that's all that they've ever intended to do. That's the innocence that I mean. You can be in wrenching grief about what has been done to certain groups of people on the planet without making yourself guilty for it. Oddly enough, that makes you more available to hear other people's pain than the guilt. In a very complex way, the guilt makes us less available to hear. It protects us. It's almost a protective layer, however uncomfortable it is, from actually meeting someone else's pain that is related to actions that I or my people or my ancestors have done. Is this speaking to you?
Very much.
Do you want to say anything about what's coming up for you?
Oh, it's pretty big. It's just allowing parts of me, as you speak, to open to that. It's been so confusing to hold
all the information that I have, and it's limited because I'm one person, all the information that I have, it's been so hard to reconcile, to come to any sense of power beyond my grief. My grief is so big about particularly the Indigenous population here, that's things that are still going on between the government and misunderstandings and policies that so don't serve, and, you know, just a culture of how we settle this place, and unidentified shame, really. All I'm really talking about is the same stuff that I've got, which is my shame, my guilt, it locks me. It locks me up. And as you say that, it's just opened for me the possibility that I and my ancestors, my direct ancestors, have been acting with as much integrity as they've known how, or we've known how, in any moment. I just hadn't held that quite so deeply, so I'm just appreciating that suggestion to open towards that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I have two questions. With regard to the question that Kate just asked, if you are able to let go of the guilt and shame, do you hold on to any sense of responsibility?
It depends on what you mean by responsibility. Because people mean very many different things by responsibility.
To the extent that I don't act now when faced with injustice, I take responsibility for that. I mean,
what does that mean, that you take responsibility for that? That's exactly what I want to unpack.
That's a choice that I have made, that I own that choice, that I didn't get out and march, that I didn't call my congressman, that I didn't do whatever it is.
That's the observation. And what does the responsibility mean?
It has to do with acting incongruently with my beliefs.
Here's how I think about it. Maybe what you call responsibility is what comes up when you do the, you know, like the restorative circles or the healing and reconciliation process in NVC, which is that when you remove the guilt and the shame, you then are left with an unprotected human heart that is looking at the consequences of your actions. Personally or collectively, you look at the consequences of that, and there is such grief that can come up. I think that's the piece that to me most speaks of responsibility in that pure, clean human sense of it. Does that speak to you?
Yes, it does. Let me ask my second question. You were talking about dialogue and about being open to being changed. What I want to know is, can true dialogue take place if only one person is open to being changed?
If that person is you, then you can be in dialogue. You are in dialogue, and the other person initially may not be. And then you, with your love and openness, if you have that strength, you can contribute to their willingness to be open through showing them that they matter to you, that you wouldn't want to do anything that is going to be harmful to them in any way, that you're really committed to arriving at something that both of you can be okay with. And by showing this degree of commitment and empathy, the other person is likely to have a shift also. Why not?
Wow. Thank you. It's a shocking answer. It's a very heavy answer.
Heavy in what sense?
When I think of a dialogue, I think of an interaction, kind of a mutual interaction, verbal interaction between two people. What I just heard was that if the only person who's open to shift is me, then there's this huge, it feels like a burden. It feels so heavy that there's so much love that needs to be coming out of me to even make it possible for the other person to hear me.
So this is what Gandhi did. He was willing to put in enough love for both sides. He was willing to die so there would be enough love. This is the heart of nonviolence. When I imagine the work that I'm doing, I think of it as training myself and everyone who's willing to be little Gandhis. I'm not any more interested in the idea of using NVC to make your life go a little better. I'm interested in teaching NVC in a way that makes people willing to be the ones to stand tall in the storm and say, I am here, I won't go, I will love. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to show my true colors. Thank you. So I hope this is a quick follow-up.
I found a couple of the things that you said just now striking, challenging, and very inspiring. To help those kinds of statements land more lightly to others, I tend to think of these things as being on a continuum.
Yes.
I am never totally willing to be in dialogue. I just can't get there. And the other person is never totally unwilling.
Oh, so thank you. Bless your heart. Thank you. I really like that. Thanks.
I'll try and make it quick. What you said is very familiar to me. It really resonates with what I've been trying to do for years and my work and in my personal life. I was realizing as I was listening to you how I tend, though, to black and white thinking, where I have no clue what to do on the other side of that. I realized when we were talking about feelings last time and other times that's my challenge. Somehow to even imagine how my being vulnerable, rather than offering empathy as my only tool, my only thing that I do, especially in close relationships, I don't know what else. I don't know if you understand where I'm coming from.
I am not entirely clear. I think I'd like you to try again to summarize what you said and make it shorter.
It comes back to the idea of if we, in fact, have something that's a burden for us and we have to share it or we'd like to share it, that's where it's really hard for me. The open-hearted empathy is much easier to do than to present what I'm needing. And so
yeah.
We're talking interdependence, and it's
yes.
The other side of that that I have a hard time with.
Got it, yes. So part of the art of interdependence, and it's especially tricky for women, I'm making a sweeping generalization, not all women and not no men, as a conditioning. It's especially hard for women and especially hard for therapists. So you can imagine how hard it will be for women therapists, which is to recognize that the full flow only happens when both parties hear each other. And that oftentimes it feels complete, falsely complete, when you hear the other person with an open heart and feel that softening in you. It feels like a little completion, but it doesn't have the transformative magical power because that person, you have not given the other person the gift of your truth, the gift of your heart and what it contains. So it is critical to find a way to express ourselves too. Did this speak to your concern?
It definitely states it, and I'd love to know sometime. That's like a whole blank to me. I just don't know how to do that.
Yeah, so I think for you, from the little that I know of you, I think I'd like you to practice expressing yourself in jackal, if that's what it takes, in role plays.
Okay.
Just loosen up some idea that you can't speak your truth by speaking the most uncensored version of it. And then once you say that, then you can look at it and go, okay, so what's important to me? What are the needs here? What's the message that I want to say to the other person? Just do that again and again. You can do it in writing, with empathy buddies, whatever, until you get yourself unblocked.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Okay.
I'd just like to mention the relationship I have with a very, very close person, very dear to me, who is, and I'm going to try not to label, has a clinical condition, but I don't see it that way. I see it as somebody who has a lot of difficulty feeling loved by herself and by others.
If you're looking for language that is descriptive, what is absolutely accurate, if it's true, is that this person may have been given a diagnosis. Saying a person with a clinical diagnosis, that's a description. Mm-hmm. Saying a person with a clinical condition, that's an evaluation. Somebody gave this person a clinical diagnosis. Then you are not developing a relationship with the diagnosis, you're just pointing to it. If you say this person has this condition, it's like you are agreeing to participate in a world in which those diagnoses have truth. Do you see the difference?
Yes. I just wanted to say the power of exactly what you were saying. When you enter into a dialogue, basically with full open heart, and starting initiating a dialogue, probably on your own at first, and opening up to that person so that that person feels so safe and so loved and so accepted that they accept to open their heart. I've witnessed this so many times with that person who is considered impossible to have empathy. The person has been said to not be able to have empathy. And I'm just completely amazed by how nonviolent communication can really help people who are considered hopeless actually open up and just cry and leave the anger and leave the violence and just feel capable of talking from heart to heart. What you just mentioned is exactly what I've discovered by being able to have a dialogue that you are initiating on your own, but
yes,
that ends up being a true dialogue.
Yes.
And I really appreciate you pointing that out.
Thank you
very much.
I like to say there are no difficult people. They're only people that are outside my current skill level.
Thank you.
Thank you. So what I would like you to do now is I'd like to have you go into groups of three or four. I want you to just review the concepts that you read in the materials, and I want you to ask yourself two questions. One is, where is your understanding of this? Just discuss with each other, you know, what presented that conceptual challenge, and, you know, take a few minutes for this. And then we'll do another small group where we look at where people may be challenged in living this, in the practice of it. What I would like you to do now in your groups is to just review whatever concepts stand out to you. Obviously, we can't get into all of it. Whatever stands out to you of what you read, what do you understand? What do you not understand? What raises questions? What is challenging to grasp? What is challenging to integrate? That's the field that I want you to take some time to talk in your small group. Thank you, everyone. So I'm curious to hear if the conversations raised any more questions that you would like to delve into, that you would like to hear my opinion about.
Our group was talking about inclusive decision making, and I was wondering, is it a given that we always choose to connect with people, or is there ever a situation, according to NBC, where you can choose not to connect and walk away? Has that ever been an option with Marshall? Or is it above all and underwriting everything that there will be an attempt at a connection no matter what?
These are very, very powerful questions. And the first thing that I want to say is that I want us to keep asking these questions, because what I want is new answers. And those are going to unfold over time. I don't know the answer to how it will all work out. All I know is the way we're doing it now is not honoring our interdependence. You with me on that?
You mean the way it is in the world today?
Yes.
Okay. Is that meaning to some extent that it's imperative that we try to make connection?
It's not so much that it's imperative that we try to make connection. for me, it's imperative that we think about interdependence moment by moment and ask the question, for now, what do I do in this moment? Do I prioritize connection or not? And why not? What's leading me to want to leave? Is it habit? Is it clarity? You see what I mean?
Yeah, I think in my case, sometimes it's a laziness. It's when it's challenging, I want to walk away because it's challenging.
There you go. So the question is, how do you make the commitment to yourself to challenge yourself so that you can learn something different? Because, see, fair weather interdependence doesn't really change anything. I will hold everybody's needs for as long as it's easy. I'll be nonviolent for as long as everybody's eyes are what I want. These are extraordinarily deep and challenging spiritual questions. They're just that. We don't have a template. We don't have an answer that's been given to us. We know how to do the old thing because we've been trained. We are in the process of figuring out the new thing, and we can only figure it out by getting messy, trying things out, and learning, and sharing with others what we're learning. So I can see situations in which I am assessing the situation, and I'm thinking to myself, given all that I know about the situation, all that I know about my resources, the resources of this other person, the task at hand, the purpose that we have, and all of this leads me to believe that it's not a good use of resources to continue dialogue. That's very different from, it's too challenging, I'm going away.
Yeah, and I think the first part was more what I was talking about, but it did get me to thinking the way you phrased that. Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
One of the questions that I was still pondering at the end of our group was the aspect of valuing ourselves and acknowledging how difficult it is for me to connect and really ask for my own needs, like meeting the needs of others so that I'm coming from out of my own care for others. And you specified whether or not they're able to ask for support.
Yes.
It just begs the question for me about the about really checking out and knowing what are ways to make it easier for people to tell us that, hey, you can contribute to me.
Yes.
do you kind of get my question?
I do. Because part of where this particular line came from is that in this culture in particular, the intensity of the injunction to self-sufficiency is such that someone I know has a friend, not her closest friend, but a pretty good friend, whose son just had a motorcycle accident and became paralyzed from the shoulders down. And she had to ask her three times before the woman said, okay, you can bring me some food. Do you see what I mean?
In my own experience, how difficult it is to open myself to really accepting.
Yeah.
And so in that way, yeah, I see the challenge. I guess that I just don't want to overstep my bounds if I'm giving something that someone maybe doesn't like or prefer.
Yes, and so a whole lot of all of these things is about counterbalancing the habit. The habit is mind your own business, stay away, keep a distance, don't pry, don't invade, keep separate, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the cultural imperative. That's the habitual behavior. And what I'm asking you to do is to stretch yourself into what will happen if you start questioning those assumptions, if you start questioning those behaviors, if you start taking risks in a place that is almost taboo. Not because I know what the right thing to do is, but because I want you to discover the truth for you that is not based on habits.
I'm probably going to have to find some minor relationships or something to test this in. I'm a little wary of getting my, I don't know,
You need a lot of inner strength in order to take these kinds of risks. And if you remember, I said I was going to break things down into two levels. The next conversation that's going to happen in a few minutes, that's my plan, is for you to look at where does it get emotionally challenging for you and to give each other empathy to get to the needs that keep you from experimenting.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
So I have two questions, but I'm just going to leave those questions because I think what came up is much more important for me right now. When I became a mother, I used to be a super radical feminist. And being a mother, feeling for the first time that I can't wash myself, I can't even take a bite, I can't even, you know, because I'm having so much fun having this little babe in my arms and really feeling the connection between him and myself and realizing, wow, there's some energy between us. It was my first experience with interdependence. It was quite something that really shifted something in my mind where I was finally able to let go of my belief of self-sufficiency and sort of be able to ask, can you please bring me a box of cookies? I haven't, or like, can you please bring me a meal? Because I am hungry and I can't eat and I can't prepare anything right now. My bones hurt. I'm exhausted. I've been breastfeeding for the past 24 hours, and I'd need a glass of water, for instance. What I find interesting is this opening has given me the possibility to give at that level to a lot of people in my community, other mothers. There is a little old lady who's 82 that lives right in front of my home. You know, she wasn't feeling well, so I brought her cookies. And what I think is very interesting about this, when you recognize this form, like this is like a beginning of understanding of interdependence, is how it really affects people in my neighborhood. And I think that's amazing because, you know, they see you bringing cookies to the old ladies and helping out the lady with her I don't know how you say it, poussette, with the baby, and they're like, they feel like doing the same. So I think it's really fun because all the people in my neighborhood are starting to really be aware of the old lady and the young mother who just had her little baby. And it's just so powerful to see how just being yourself will affect others, will influence them.
And
I think
it reminds me of some research that I've heard of that I haven't really followed up. Any of you who might be interested, there is a category, you know, everybody likes to come up with terms and categories, that is called consistent contributors. These are people who are essentially consistently and willingly doing more than their share, always ready to help, always ready to give, not saying, well, I've done enough, now it's your turn, you know, like really just all the time contributing. That when you have a consistent contributor in a group, the group functioning improves. That's the piece that I saw. And that's what I'm thinking about when I'm hearing the role that you've had in your community. You've been a consistent contributor is how I'm interpreting it.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions before we move to the next part? Anything that anybody would like me still to elaborate on in terms of the concept? So before we go into the groups, I have one thing that feels really important for me to say, which is that I see some kind of an analogy between interdependence and needs. Here's how I see it work. In terms of needs, we all have them. And I think those of us who have been practicing NVC for a while, we know that we all have them, and not only do we have them, they are continually affecting our actions in all kinds of ways. And that what we have choice about is whether we act on the consciousness of needs or not. And that when we act on the consciousness of needs, the results, we tend to like them better. In a very similar manner, I see interdependence as a fact of life. It's just there. The relationships are there. However, if I consciously align myself with the realization that interdependence is the way life works and make choices that take interdependence into consideration, I end up functioning in ways that increase the well-being for me and others. I just wanted to do that analogy before we continue. What I would like to do next is I actually would like to take maybe 20 minutes in the same groups and have each person get about a 6-minute turn in which you look at the question of your relationship to this idea of embracing interdependence, either generally or specific practices. What is challenging for you? What appeals to you? And wherever you find challenge, have the rest of the group, the other two people, support you with empathy to identify your needs so that you can really get in touch with what's keeping you from embracing the practice and what might motivate you to embrace the practice, and just see where that takes you as a human being. That's what I'm asking you to do. Hello, welcome back, everyone. And I am wishing to dedicate the rest of our time together to just work with what has emerged in your groups and any questions and comments or requests for support that may be alive based on the work that you did in your groups. I, first of all, want to get a quick feedback. I don't remember. So I am would like people to press 4. If you got some self-understanding from the work that we did now. Just I'm going to ask, you know, like 2 or 3 questions just to give me quick feedback. If you got more connected with understanding yourself and where you're coming from and why you do things. Thank you. That's most people. Second question is if you have more of a sense of having a grasp on what living interdependently means, please press 4. Thank you. Also a bunch of people, but fewer. And the last question is if you have a sense that you were able to support others in the group when it was their turn, I would like to hear from you by pressing 4. So that is, it's really interesting. It's fewer than the people who experienced having more self-understanding, which I imagine people experienced receiving support for that. Now I'm curious. Let's put that to a test. So there are 9 people who experienced themselves as able to offer support. I'd like to know how many people experienced receiving support. So that's 12, almost everyone. So I'm finding it interesting just in terms of the very things that we're talking about, that more people experienced receiving support than experienced able to offer it. I just want to, you know, put this in the mix of what people think about. And now I want to open the conversation to what did you learn? What did you feel challenged about? What do you want to have further deepening of? Anything that you want to explore in the group at this point?
When I read Getting From Heart, it really struck me because I always struggle with that, as I share with my group. When I went to a women retreat with NVC, and I keep asking the facilitator whether if being fair is it a need or not, because I have a strong need to be fair, witness fair and to be fair to other people. And I'm still confused whether that fair is a need or not. That's one thing, that fairness and responsibility kept me away from opening up myself and giving joyfully.
Yeah. So I'm really glad you're bringing up the question of fairness, because I see fairness, and this is kind of like an advanced concept. In other words, in an introductory workshop, I completely I'm happy for people to identify fairness as a need that they have. When I'm trying to be rigorous and accurate and really look at things, I think of fairness as an evaluative concept rather than a need. And very, very tightly connected to notions of deserve and right-wrong thinking. It's only right that this would be this way because that's the fair thing. And it's not necessarily what is it that people need. So I think of fairness as kind of like a substitute for the deep desire to find a way to hold everyone's needs with care. I have more to say. I just want to check in with you if this is speaking to you so far.
It is a deep desire to find a way to connect with other people.
No, a deep desire to have everyone's needs matter.
Right. Okay.
Now, the other issue with fairness is that when I think about what is fair, I am in some ways detaching myself from the emotional reality of the situation. Let's say it's fair for you to do the dishes today because you haven't done them in 5 days. If I then insist that you do the dishes because it's only fair, I'm no longer in touch with the actual possibility that your inner life, where you are, would line up in a way that will make it possible for you to do the dishes with an energy that I won't regret later. So instead of thinking about what's fair, I try to think about what's possible. Is this enough?
Thank you.
Yes. Thanks.
Along the issues of interdependence and responsibility, when I state my need and I'm getting my needs met, am I responsible for others not having their needs met because my desire is for interdependence and connectedness? In other words, if they're not getting their needs met, is that my responsibility?
So technically, I'm not responsible for meeting other people's needs. I'm only responsible for meeting my needs.
You've done your work, as it were, to discover what the other person's need might be.
Yes, then the question is, am I moved to offer strategies that will perhaps meet their needs? Is it the truth that I have? If I am going to do something just because that's the fair thing, I'm likely to feel resentful. If I'm doing something because I'm connected with the care and generosity that live in my heart, I'm not going to be resentful. You see?
So, Veronica, do you mind if I bring up your example?
Let me give her a mic. Yeah.
Yes, please.
Okay, well, her example was not feeling joyful. If I'm saying this wrong, correct me, Veronica, but not feeling joyful in giving, cooking dinner, the responsibility of cooking dinner. And if she were to say, I have a need to rest tonight because I'm tired of cooking and for whatever reason, and no one steps forward to offer to fill that void, where's the issue of responsibility? And
why is Veronica more responsible for food than anyone else?
I guess that's the question.
Well, it's the culture, and I hope to give, but I just cannot give joyfully. I really want to give joyfully. So that's what bothers me, is that I cannot give joyfully. I don't know which need is higher.
I think you can't give joyfully because you don't experience choice about giving. So even though there's a cultural context, if you talk to whoever you are concerned would have a reaction to this and say, here's the dilemma, I really want to do the work that I do for cooking or whatever, I want to do it wholeheartedly and with joy, and right now I don't. And I'm very confident if from time to time you're okay to step in and I can take a break, that will give me so much more joy. Because then I know that I'm choosing it rather than being forced to do it. Are you willing to do that from time to time? You see? It's a big deal.
It's whether I have the courage to open up the conversation also.
Yeah, it's the question of courage will keep coming up. Because living from the place that NVC invites us to always requires courage, because it will put you in some ways at odds with the culture that you are in, no matter what the culture is. All the cultures that I know prioritize certain sets of needs over others. And so if you want to be open to all needs of all people, you will be at odds with your culture sooner or later in one form or another. And then it's the question of courage. And if you don't have the courage, then at least you can be compassionate with yourself and know that you are making a choice to meet your need for peace and harmony, rather than that you have to. Was this enough for you?
I like that you said it's a choice. Mm-hmm. That changes it completely from responsibility to choice. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you both.
One of the things we were talking about in our group was the concept of self-sufficiency. I've looked at self-sufficiency a lot as creating choice in my life to not participate with actions that didn't live in line with my values. I'm not sure how to integrate that all.
Recently, I've been in conversations, and I think they haven't made it yet to the handout, which is a new distinction between self-sufficiency and self-reliance. Self-reliance, I think, is what you're talking about, is being able to rely on your own resources so that you can live more in line with your values. Did I get that accurately?
Yes, and that can include community.
Yes. And self-sufficiency is the illusion that says that you can meet your needs on your own without other people. It's never been true for humans, and it never will be true for humans. Right now, we are masking our dependence through money, but the dependence is there.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Could I ask one more question?
Yes.
I'm just wondering about the trusting that we matter without external validation.
Yes, that's inner strengthening, and for most of us will require getting it from others first until we can internalize it. Can you sit with that? Because there are two more people with hands up, and we're getting close to the end, and I really want to be able to close spaciously. Yeah?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Something that came up for me was about choice as well. I was talking about wanting control. Claudia was kind enough to help me understand that as wanting choice, and that was so much more expansive and positive.
Thank you.
Just to ponder about courage, I always talk to my son about Gandhi and Jesus and Martin Luther King, and he said something very interesting. He said, you know, Mom, what really, really worries me about all these nonviolent people is either they get judged or assassinated.
I can say something really brief about this. This is like a whole other topic. I think one of the things that nonviolent movements did not understand in the past, and I think are beginning to understand, is something about making the leaders dispensable. And when the leaders are dispensable, they're less at risk.
Thanks.
Thank you. I would like to move towards closing. And the way I would like to close today, because this topic is so radical and so dear to my heart, I would like to hear a one-liner from each person on the call. What you're taking away with you that you're going to keep mulling over, whether you're changing anything or not, it doesn't matter. What's resonant for you? One-liner.
The possibility of holding my beliefs more lightly, and that will be in more integrity when I'm asking people to consider changing their beliefs.
Thank you.
Valuing myself and expressing my own needs is going to take a lot of courage.
Thank you.
Holding the intention to connect with the needs of others while I'm expressing my needs.
Thank you.
To be able to give joyfully, but out of my own choice.
Thank you.
I have a choice about whether to connect.
Thank you.
Making requests from others, even though it requires courage from me, is an opportunity to give others the chance to contribute to life.
Thank you.
Being more conscious and aware of the dance of interdependence in contributing to everyone's needs.
Thank you.
The power that NVC gives me to contribute to my and others' healings in order to create a true dialogue from heart to heart.
Thank you.
Interdependence is not a need, it's a fact, and I have a need to recognize it and integrate it into my being.
Thank you.
I look to practice expressing myself in Jackal, and I'm going to try risking that my needs matter.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Really wanting to experience my needs mattering with other people and within myself.
Thank you.
Expressing my feelings and needs has the potential for increasing my own and others' well-being.
Thank you.
A spaciousness to explore holding my own needs and other people's needs in inclusive decision-making when taking away the shoulds.
Thank you.
Reminder of always being willing to shift where I might be in any given moment.
And for me, what I am living with right now is just an incredible sense of satisfaction. I have such a deep desire to be able to teach all the radical things in less time with more effectiveness, and seeing what you all have taken in this period of time is so gratifying to me that I am just fully with that. Thank you. You've made my day. Bye-bye.